This episode of Coffee House Shots is sponsored by Alliance Witten Investment Trust. From the OPEC oil crisis of the 1970s, the financial crash in 2008, to the COVID epidemic and Liz Truss's doomed premiership, there has been no shortage of economic crises over the last 58 years. And yet, throughout that time, every single year, without fail, we've paid out an increased dividend to our shareholders. In fact, Alliance Witten's history dates all the way back to 1888. And today, we manage around £5 billion in assets. If you're looking for a less stressful way to invest in stocks and shares, learn more about Alliance Witten and find your comfort zone.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Oscar Edmondson. I'm joined by Michael Simmons and Isabel Hardman. And Michael, the market turmoil is continuing, of course, but maybe slight reprieve this morning?
Yeah, so we seem to have had a bit of a bounce back day in the markets, really. The FTSE's just closed here in London and it's closed up 2.7%. The American stock exchanges are kind of up a bit as well. They're obviously still down relative to the big drops we saw at the end of last week and yesterday, but things seem to have recovered. On a personal note, I just went and looked at my very small stocks and shares ISA, and everything's green for once, which is nice.
Oh, amazing.
Hey.
I've been putting off looking. So now we've got that confirmation from the economics editor. Everyone has a license to go and look now.
Well, this is the thing. I think you can look for the day, and it seems to have sort of come, this kind of positive change in markets, it seems to have come from two factors, really. It's one, it's people buying the dip. I think I wrote on Coffee House the other day that on Thursday, when the sort of turmoil was starting, we had one of the busiest days for kind of retail buyers. So, you know, people like us thinking that there's opportunities when things are priced low. But also it was a factor of Donald Trump made some comments about that he thought there was going to be a tariff deal with China, and he was just waiting for them to pick up the phone. And I think markets have priced in that these tariffs are going to be negotiated away. Now, that's a big if. If that happens, then maybe the markets, you know, are on their way to recovery. But if that doesn't happen and these tariffs are not negotiated away, and if China and the China and America sort of aspect of the trade war escalates, then the rug could really be pulled again and we could see even bigger droppers. So although today kind of things are in green, I don't think by any means that, you know, we're out of any sort of economics woods yet.
And Isabel, it is the day that MPs will leave Westminster for the Easter break. So as is customary, the Prime Minister was, of course, in front of the liaison committee this afternoon, where he was grilled on topics including tariffs, defence and welfare. Could you take us through some of your highlights and lowlights from this afternoon?
Well, I think as is customary, news was not really committed in this session. I think it was 2022 when news was last committed at the liaison committee, which was when Boris Johnson had that intensely painful session shortly before being ejected from power. And today we heard a lot from Keir Starmer that we've already heard before. So all options on the table regarding tariffs, but not wanting to retaliate immediately, turbocharging the economy. He likes the word turbocharging. Mm. And I find it quite entertaining because at the same time as turbocharging, he's also relaxing targets on electric cars, which really could do with being turbocharged from time to time, says the owner of a very old electric car that keeps running out of battery. So on tariffs, yeah, I don't think we learned anything that was particularly interesting on tariffs. I think there were a couple of interesting exchanges. One was on social care. So he was defending the fact that the government has parked long-term reform of social care by giving Louise Casey this review. But he did insist that the review that Louise Casey is carrying out will deliver some earlier changes than its final report. He couldn't actually find the date in his notes. That wasn't very helpful. But he basically said that there would be some reforms that could be implemented earlier. That's not particularly helpful still, because the key problem with the sector is its long-term financial sustainability or lack of. Mm. And that's not going to be answered until the review finally publishes. And even that's not really an answer. That's a suggestion. And then the government in the next parliament after the election needs to work out what it's going to do still. So it was not particularly reassuring. I think another important exchange was on the OBR and welfare reform. And this has been something that Starmer, Rachel Reeves in particular, and to a certain extent Liz Kendall, have really lent on following the budget, following the additional cuts to welfare that they had to announce, and their earlier package of welfare reforms that they announced the week before, where they have kept saying, but the OBR hasn't taken into account the impact of getting people back into work that our reforms will have. Now, I'm sort of old and bitter enough now to find the word will very difficult in politics, because it rarely is accurate, and could is often still quite an ambitious replacement. But the OBR is supposed to be carrying out this impact assessment of what the back to work reforms could do in terms of the economy over the summer, and then reporting back. And there was an interesting exchange between Starmer and Debbie Abrahams, Labour MP, who's chair of the Work and Pensions Select Committee, about whether or not there would be legislation after the OBR had finally produced this impact assessment or before. And Michael, I know you've obviously carried out a huge amount of research into this. I don't know how much confidence you actually have in those back to work reforms, and whether Reeves is right to lean on them so heavily, or whether it's really one of those political devices of, but they haven't taken into account our wonderful plan that is not going to deliver the things that it will allegedly deliver.
Yeah, I think it's almost surprising for Starmer to take a pop at the OBR in this way, just because of how clear it seems to me anyway that these reforms were done with the OBR in mind. I mean, the way that they initially claimed they had this 5 billion saving, and I remember you and I were texting on the day saying, where has this come from? And then lo and behold, it turned out that the OBR had, you know, come up with a smaller amount, and there was this back and forth between the Treasury, the DWP and the OBR. And the result was, as we've said on this podcast many times now, the headroom against Rachel Reeves' ironclad fiscal rules went back to the exact same 9.9 billion she started with. Now, to me, if you were doing genuine reforms because you believed that it was the right thing either to save a load of money, or it was the right thing because it was going to get a bunch more people into work, then you wouldn't land back on that exact figure. So I've always thought that these reforms were not actually about what Liz Kendall, what Rachel Reeves, what Keir Starmer think is the right thing to do to reform benefits and to reform the labour market, but it was more about hitting, you know, certain positions on an OBR chessboard or an OBR abacus. So for that reason, I'm sort of surprised that Starmer's kind of criticised them there in the Liaison Committee, but I suppose I can see the frustration.
And on those fiscal rules, Michael, I mean, Keir Starmer recommitted yesterday to not raising income tax, VAT or employee NI for the duration of the parliament, and reiterated his support for these ironclad fiscal rules. But is there inevitably going to have to be some wiggle room?
Well, there's going to have to be some sort of movement on something. I mean, I wish I could tell listeners what it would be, but if you look in the sort of the nitty gritty detail of the report that the OBR released for the spring statement, this was obviously before we knew that the full extent of the tariffs that Trump was going to unleash. And they considered three scenarios for tariffs. And in their middle scenario, they basically consider that every country in the world gets 20% tariffs, including the UK, and sort of not, and there's not a general retaliation. Now, obviously, we escaped and got the 10% tariffs. But if you factor in that, you know, some countries obviously have retaliated, that sort of middle scenario looks sort of closest to the kind of economic reality that the world finds itself in. And under that scenario, they sort of look at what the effect would be on inflation, on GDP, on unemployment, etc. And they basically find that the forecast they've given Rachel Reeves would be wrong to the extent that her headroom would be wiped out to just £300 million. Now, as a percent of GDP, that's 0.0%. So in other words, that's a rounding error away from her headroom being wiped out again, and in autumn, you know, just being back into that position that she's escaped from a few weeks ago. So given that we already, it seems to me, we already seem to be in that situation, I think it's quite brave that the Prime Minister, you know, so explicitly said that we're sticking to the fiscal rules and we're not putting up those major taxes, because I don't think there's a lot to be found from other taxes. Presumably, they're not going to put up employer NICs again soon. I don't think they're going to go on a borrowing spree, because the markets wouldn't like that, and that puts the second fiscal rule in trouble. And presumably, sort of mass austerity is not really an option. So it's hard for me to escape the thought that, you know, it might not be specifically the rules he tells Rachel Reeves to break, but I think he's going to eat his words that he said yesterday. You know, either those rules are going to have to change or taxes are going up.
Mm. And Isabel, just finally, not to plug a rival publication, but I very much enjoyed your recent article in The Observer about how the Lib Dems are pitching themselves ahead of the local elections. Can you tell listeners about it?
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously they're going to be doing stunts, because Ed Davey without stunts would be more newsworthy than Ed Davey with stunts at this point. He launched the local election campaign on a hobby horse doing an obstacle course. And I'm assured, perhaps even reassured, by sources close to the leader that there will be more stunts. So,
thank God.
Yeah, Middle England can relax. but in his quest to appeal to Middle England, there have been a number of, I suppose, tweaks, changes to the Lib Dem message. Chief among them is obviously that Ed Davey spends a lot more time talking about Donald Trump now and has in fact ditched social care at PMQs in favour quite often of talking about Trump and calling on Labour to have a stronger line on Donald Trump. And the reason for this is that the kind of voters that the Lib Dems are now after are still protest voters. You know, that's always been their kind of main diet, I suppose. But there are different sort of protest voters to the ones they were trying to appeal to 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Back then, it was people who were perhaps more working class or lower middle class. Now they're much more, I suppose, internationalist. And they still have the anxiety about where things are going as those previous voters. But instead of really being sort of concerned about Britain losing its past and its identity, which was a surprising ingredient in Lib Dem voting, or in what Lib Dems themselves found baffling, which was Lib Dem switching to UKIP, something that, you know, if you were working for Nick Clegg at the time, you didn't understand, because you thought all Lib Dems kind of believed in, or whatever they believed in, but certainly not UKIP's beliefs. It's moved from that to an anxiety about where the world is going and the world shutting down and, you know, I suppose a more modern expression of the anxieties of centrists following Brexit. It's not fashionable to talk about Brexit very much anymore. That's, you know, so last decade. Whereas now talking about Trump and needing to stand up to him and have a sort of, I suppose, a Hugh Grant and Love Actually moment is a better articulation of the anxieties of those Middle England voters who are, you know, in the home counties. They've voted Tory all their lives. They're very centrist. They have children in flats affected by the cladding crisis. They feel that no one speaks for them. They listen to the rest is politics. That's their kind of articulation of their anxieties. But that's been one of the tweaks. And another one that I found fascinating as, you know, someone who covers the Commons, is that a decade ago, I don't think a particularly unfair summary of the Lib Dem defence policy would be, why can't we all just get on? And we don't like Trident. Or could we just have three boats in Trident? And could we keep them up a hill until we need them, sort of thing? And now they're much more into talking about defence. They're very active at defence questions or in any statement in the Commons about the need to spend more money on defence. That's partly because the world has changed and the consensus about needing to spend more money on defence has spread from just Tories and defence fanatics to Middle England. It's also because their voters are much more worried about this, and also because their MPs, a lot of them have military backgrounds now. So it has been an interesting shift. I suspect, though, you know, if you still went to Lib Dem conference, they'd still have motions on goldfish, for instance. But in terms of the sort of national articulation of their policy, Ed Davey is trying to appeal to a different section of the electorate now.
Great. Well, thank you, Isabel. Thank you, Michael. And thank you very much for listening.